The well howdy was in there, but I had the wrong button pushed. Sorry. See, I go away for, you know, we're just gone for a couple of days and everything goes to hell. Thanks for affording me the Monday off. I do appreciate it. We had a lovely evening. Ferg is now a 16-year-old. Dear God, help us all. But yes, thanks for the time away, and I appreciate your patience. It was a nice evening. And let's see, next up on the birthday list, we get a little break until it's Margie's turn. And that'll be a big one. That's bigger than 16. She'll be 18 come February. Then comes Doodle in March. And Agnes in April. Gonna be busy. But we'll deal with that as it comes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. We like to call it Conversation Radio. For those of you who may just now be discovering us via any of a number of functionalities, be it TuneIn Radio, be it iTunes Radio, be it podcast, be it Stitcher. The stream runs live as well as in delay on podcast now. It's quite exciting. Stitcher now. Still, it's quite exciting. And, mercifully, Christmas is over. Safe for another year, I suppose. I hope yours was nice. Ours was. It was very quiet. And it wasn't... Christmas changes when the little ones go from being little ones to being angst-ridden teenagers. But, anyway, it was a nice Christmas, and I hope yours was as well. And we're still eating leftovers. And that's nice. And so now it's downhill to finishing out 2011 and maybe getting a handle on getting 2012 started. We don't have any countdown lists. There's just not enough. Frankly, all the volunteers, and this is an entirely volunteer effort, you know that. There's just not enough time out there to put together a top 10 or a best of or a worst of or... No, we'll just continue doing the show until we stop saying 2011 and we start saying 2012. Seems rational, doesn't it? So, nonetheless, as the year does wind out, it's hard not to reflect upon it. I sent out one tweet sometime over the weekend saying, the worst thing about coming into 2012 is that we will be inundated for something on the order of 51 weeks about Mayan prophecies and the Mayan calendar and the Mayan prediction of the end of the world. Please. So just sort of strap in and get ready for that, because there will probably be a story a week. And, of course, it's all, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, poppycock. Because calendars are just calendars. And every calendar has an arbitrary starting date, whether it be Ab Urbe Condita, 753 before the Common Era, or whatever the starting point is in for the Chinese calendar, the Jewish calendar, the Muslim calendar, the Mayan calendar. The Mexica got their calendar from the Mayans. It's all arbitrary. So just keep that in mind as the countdown to doom, Mayan calendar 2012. I'm sure there's already a Mayan calendar countdown clock out there, isn't there? Don't tell me if there is. I don't want to know. So that's going to be a little bit frustrating. But along those same lines, you know, we were gone yesterday. Took the night off for Ferg. He said, Dad, could that be your birthday present to me? No, yeah. Yeah, it was. So that meant we missed Yeah, see, Texas Betsy noting the Jewish calendar is 5,763 years old. The only problem with that being that there was no culture to be counting dates from that time. At some point in time, the calendar was invented and a date and a retroactive date was applied. The Romans didn't start counting at 753 before the Common Era either. And neither did the Mayans start counting at 52,000 years, because frankly we haven't been that human that long. So, you know, just bear that in mind as the disaster predictions, be it one a week, one a day, you know, they're going to be there. But anyway, no, we missed Moran Monday because I was away. But that doesn't mean the Morans weren't in evidence. It started on Christmas Eve. It started on Christmas Eve in Rome with the message of Pope Benedict, the child rapist cover-upper, and his message to the world, his Midnight Mass homily. The quote from that, translated into English, having been delivered originally in Italian by a guy who was born speaking German. Today, Christmas has become a commercial celebration whose bright lights hide the mystery of God's humility, which in turn calls us to humility and simplicity. Let us ask the Lord to help us see through the superficial glitter of this season and to discover behind it the child in the stable in Bethlehem, so as to find true joy and true light. See through the superficial glitter of this season. You know what? If a guy wearing the robes of a Palestinian day laborer with rough-made sandals on his feet said that, I'd stand up and cheer and say, "You tell him, brother! Or father, or your eminent noble graciousness, or whatever we're supposed to call you, you tell them." But when a guy wearing clothes that glitter with real gold and studded with gemstones tells us to see through the superficial glitter of the season, well, how do you not just kind of save that one for the next show, huh? Hypocrisy much, Benny? Yeah, right. But that's where it started. We need to see through the superficial glitter of the season. I guess maybe by definition, his robes, which if they were sold, could probably feed a poor family for a month of Sundays. That glitter, being, you know, real 24 karat gold, that glitter's not superficial glitter. That's the real glitter, and we don't need to see through that, right? So, you know, just an early nomination. But God, I'm not going to play the music or do the, you know, head for the, no, or the carnival barker or anything, because it's Tuesday. That's just a little weird. But really, tonight we're kind of going to be dealing with our leftover Morans. Because you know what? Leftovers after Christmas are just fine. And these are some dandy good leftover Morans. I mean restaurant quality. For instance, you know, now don't everybody tune away, you know that the NFL season, all the games were played on Saturday since Christmas fell on Sunday, and the NFL plays on Sunday, so they played on Saturday. Well, the Buffalo Bills played host to the Denver Broncos. And Well, Buffalo went on a terrible, terrible skid and couldn't win a game to save its soul until Denver came to town. Got an email from our buddy John in New York who said, well, this isn't starting out well. You got to wonder how it's going to end. Well, it ended 40-14, Buffalo over Denver, the Christian army of Timmy Tebow. And that was on Christmas Eve. You know, Timmy, who always thanks God for all of his passes, the ones that are at least completed by hook or by crook, and prays in the end zone, and, you know, does all those things that Jesus was talking about, that Jesus didn't approve of, that he says the Pharisees did. Well, observing that that was happening on Christmas Eve, Bill Maher tweeted, wow, Jesus just effed Tim Tebow bad. And on Christmas Eve, somewhere in hell, Satan is Tebowing, saying to Hitler, hey, Buffalo's killing him. Probably not the funniest thing Bill Maher has ever said. But, wow, didn't that just get the... Oh, it got the fundies riled up. In particular, it got Eric Bolling, who's a sort of Beckerhead wannabe, over at Radio Rwanda. It got Eric Bolling going real good. He immediately took to his Twitter and said, Bill Maher is disgusting, vile trash. I can't even repeat what he just tweeted about Tebow on Christmas Eve. Hashtag straight to hell, Bill. The delightful moronic irony of this being that loving Christian called upon to forgive his enemies, not his friends, not the common acquaintances or occasional stranger who offend him, but Christian Eric Bolling cast atheist Bill Maher straight to hell. That's just delightful. Not the least of which because the alleged Messiah, whom Eric Bolling allegedly worships, commanded him, and, you know, there's some historical speculation behind where Jesus got the notion, Yeshua, that's his real name, you know, where Yeshua got the notion of love your enemy, probably from Socrates, because Nazareth is not that far from what was a very, very Hellenized, very cosmopolitan town called Sepphoris, which is probably where he and his dad Joseph plied their trade. And it's not entirely unthinkable that Yeshua would have been schooled in the language that was spoken by the upper crusts there, who gave work to trades and craftspeople like Yeshua Bar Yusuf. And so maybe he actually, somewhere along the way, got to read, or someone told him about, Socrates' assertions in a dialogue by Plato, of course, called the Symposium, in which, in fact, long before the crucifixion, long before Yeshua was even born, in which Socrates urges and argues that the highest form of love is the ability to love one's enemy. And so later, when he decided to become a traveling rabbi, an itinerant rabbi, as it were, Yeshua incorporated that into his doctrine and his dogma. It's the whole turn the other cheek thing. Love thine enemy. For reasons that don't bear going into. But apparently that's lost on Radio Rwanda's Eric Bowling. Straight to hell, Bill! But the funnest part of all of that is not necessarily Eric Bowling's comment, but rather those who responded to him on the Twitter. Because that was indeed precious. Over on the Twitters, things like this came up from other Christians. You know, the people who were supposed to forgive. Everybody remember the late great prophet Bill Hicks and what he said, peace be upon him? I was in Alabama, and I was after the show, and a couple of big old rednecks came up to me and said, we don't like what you said about Jesus. So I said, forgive me. Yeah, it's kind of lost on them. Over at Politics USA, Jason Easley has a list of the tweets that followed on the heels of Eric Bowling's straight to hell comment. Because straight to hell was used as a hashtag. One was a retweet. Just straight up, with Jason Easley noting, as if tweeting anything about the Golden Tebow child, other than an unconfirmed report that he may have been the byproduct of a virgin birth in a manger, is blasphemous. Then there's this tweet, never cared for Bill Maher even before he became a lib political hack posing as a comedian, but Tebow tweet was revolting. And then another tweet. If Tebow was a Muslim and prayed towards Mecca after a touchdown, would you still make fun of him? Well, Bill Maher being Bill Maher, the answer is yes. He makes fun of Muslims. He makes fun of Jews. He makes fun of Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, animists, all of them, because he sees all religion as being a pile of so much poo. So, yeah, he would. But that's the way the right... the Christians is being persecuted. They're being persecuted. He wouldn't say that about no Muslim. Yeah, he would. Yeah, I'd say he would. Oh, by the way, there was a story breaking out of Rome. Haha, breaking, you'll see. It's a pun. That another chunk of rock has... stone has fallen off of the Flavian Amphitheater there. That's what people who actually know what the building is call what the rest of the world calls the Colosseum, which comes, of course, from the word Colosseo, which means really big. But it's actually the Flavian Amphitheater. Big piece of rock fell off of it. Of course, millions of people visit it every year. And I'm sure a lot of the Americans who do it are fundies, and they want... Looky here. Oh, Marveline, looky here. We're in the Colosseum, where all them poor Christians was persecuted and feeded to the lions and the hyenas and right cheer. And Nero was a-sitting up there with his thumb down saying, feed some more to the lions. That's what he done, Marveline, it is. There's only one problem, of course. The Flavian Amphitheater was inaugurated in grand opening, I guess you'd say, in 80 of the current era, and Nero had been long gone. It is, in fact, named the Flavian Amphitheater in respect for the family of emperors of the time who built it, which was the Flavian dynasty. But ignorance goes hand in hand with fundamentalism, regardless of whatever flavor or brand of fundamentalism you're talking about. I never cared for Bill Maher even before he become a lib political hack posing as a comedian. But that tweet, Tebow tweet, was revolting. Jason Easley, who wrote this piece, was hilarious. He's got a paragraph here that just slayed me. He writes, some might say that Tim Tebow is beloved by so many evangelicals because of his faith, not his play. Anyone who criticizes Tebow or who points out the ridiculousness of the Tebow to God connection, paren, my money is on Tebow not being able to hit God if he was wide open on a 15-yard slant, earns the wrath of the religious right for criticizing their faith. Tebow's faith is getting him a free pass, paren, if thrown by Tebow, it would probably be intercepted, close paren, with many in the media. And it's true. He's getting kid gloves treatment. If it wasn't for the fact that Tim Tebow is a fundamentalist and a really vocal in-your-face one, he would be getting treated with the same amount of disdain that meets any other hack not quite up to the task quarterback, especially when they're Heisman Trophy winners who have been drafted in the first round. Because a lot of times those guys don't work out very well. But there's that. When it comes to morality. And we do have morans aplenty this evening. Ron and Raleigh noting, hey Bob, odd, but the Pope sounds a lot like Dr. Strangelove. Well, yes he does, doesn't he, Ron? I wonder why that is. Maybe it's because that's my stock bad guy German accent. Your papers are not in order. Animals could be bred and slaughtered. Mein Führer, I can walk. Yeah. By the way, Midnight Mass was boot. And see, this is one of those moments. Midnight Mass was moved back from midnight to 10 p.m. so it wouldn't be so strenuous on the octogenarian Holy Father. Now, Midnight Mass is Midnight Mass. It's not 10 p.m. Mass. There's churches all over the world that have 10 p.m. Masses, I'll bet. But if you go all the way to Rome and you go all the way to St. Peter's, you're there for Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve. I don't know. You show up and it's 10 p.m. Mass. Don't you feel a little bit cheated? What do you do at midnight? And I find that funny simply because they can change the time of one of the most traditional history-freighted events that goes on in their holy calendar that they claim they do, you know, because they have to, you know, God wants us to. But on the other hand, where the Bible is largely, where the New Testament is largely silent on whether or not women should be ordained, oh, we can't do that! Or where Jesus is silent on condoms, which definitely existed in his day and age, and he was silent on them, oh, no, you can't be putting one of those little things on your little thing, because then you won't make little babies. The special Christmas Eve Midnight Mass will be celebrated at 10 p.m. Please make a note of it. It will remain that way for the foreseeable future. Jeebus. But I don't know. It wasn't just a whole lot of white Christmas anywhere in North America, or at least in the 48 states, it was warm and sunny and downright mild on Christmas Day. There is one recipe that I've made every year since the babies were tiny because they just love it. You can look the recipe up online. It's called Oysters Bienville. And my family has been having, through good times and bad, has had oysters at Christmas for probably in excess of 100 years. Fried oysters at breakfast. My father would get up and do them. His father got up and fried oysters on Christmas morning. It's a guy thing. But for some reason or another, my oysters Bienville recipe is cursed. Yes, it's cursed. Maybe if I would say more nice things about fundamentalists, it wouldn't be. But, you know, one year, and it's a very complex recipe. You go and you look it up and you, like, say, hit the Emeril Lagasse version and see, you know, prep time, 12 days. Do not try this at home. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Here be dragons, all of that stuff. It's not that complicated, but you got to do stuff in order and have a good bit of time to dedicate to it. So one year I forgot the white wine. Another year I forgot the parsley. Another year I forgot the green onions. Every year I forget something that goes into the oysters Bienville. This year it was the mushrooms. And I will not put those rubbery, nasty little things out of a can into something that no. So it just went without. But I got to think about it, and yes, indeed, that recipe is cursed. But wow, is it yummy. So, I don't know, maybe you'd like to try them sometime. But don't forget the mushrooms, because they really just kind of bulk up the stuffing that goes on top of the oyster. The other thing, of course, is we can't get oysters in the shell anymore, and that's a pity. Because you serve them up kind of like oysters Rockefeller, you know. You put the stuffing on top of them, and they sit on a bed of rock salt, shells do, and you put them in the oven. And so now we use muffin tins. It's not quite as much fun, and the flavor's not quite the same. But this year they were mushroomless. But anyway, that was, I don't know where that aside came from, but we have oodles of Moran fun today. We've got Tea Party Morans, School Administration Morans, Fizzy Soft Drink Morans, Ron Paul Morans, kind of goes without saying, anti-democracy, opposed to voting Morans. And this one's such a stinker. Let's get it taken care of and out of the, I don't want to say out of the way, because this needs to be so much further up in our consciousness, because there's always one of these stories. Just like on Christmas, there's always a story of somebody's house burning down and 5 or 7 people dying. We had another one of those, and you just sit there and go, Jesus, please. But this story comes out of Colorado. You know, when I think about going and visiting friends on the holidays, and I try, because I'm prone to forgetting things, just like I didn't write down my oysters Bienville list. I thought it was all in my head, and I forgot my mushrooms. And so generally when I'm getting ready to go somewhere, I make a list of all the things I want to pack. You know, shoes, socks, underwear, shirts, pants, shaving kit, medicine, you know. Oddly enough, when I go to visit someone or somewhere, the first thing on my list is not deadly firearm. But apparently that was for a guy named Adam Laham, or Laham, L-A-H-A-M, 23 years old, a resident of Kansas. And he went to visit friends in Lakewood, Colorado, at an apartment complex there. Looks like there were a lot of people getting together on Friday, the 23rd of December, for some holiday cheer. It was Friday morning. That's along about the time that a 3-year-old little boy got hold of a handgun that Adam Laham had brought with him from Kansas. Let's see. Socks, check. Underwear, check. Shirt, check. Sweater, check. Jeans, check. Chinos, check. Semi-automatic pistol, check. Extra ammunition, check, check, Friday morning, the 23rd, a little 3-year-old boy found Adam Lahem's pistol pointed at his little 5-year-old pal, pulled the trigger, and made the little 5-year-old boy get all dead. Joyce Laufer lives next door to the unit where the shooting took place. She said, "It's very sad. I wasn't expecting anything like this." Neighbors said that the family that lives in the apartment where the shooting took place is very friendly, and they were just seen having a snowball fight in the yard on Thursday. A short time after the shooting, photos of firearms were found on the Facebook page of a family member listed as a resident of the apartment where the shooting took place. The same Facebook person, a few hours later, commented on his page, "One second changes everything forever." No, buddy, no. It's not one effing second. It's not one GD second. It's one effing handgun. It's one GD handgun. Well, toddlers don't kill people. Guns kill people. In the story, the police were declining to say exactly how the shooting occurred or exactly what kind of gun was used. Such information being in the course and scope of a story like this, rather superfluous, frankly. The little 3-year-old boy, growing up in America, a gun culture on steroids where he can see guns in cartoons, guns in real life, guns in TV movies, guns in TV shows, guns at the movie theater, picked up the gun and did what you do when you pick up a gun. You pointed at somebody else and pulled the trigger. See? Smart children. They pick up more than we know. They pick up more than we give them credit for. And yeah, when you've just come a-visitin' from Kansas and you just couldn't leave Kansas without your gun. Andy M., where's my M16? When you just couldn't leave Kansas without your gun, they pick up your gun, too. Bang, bang. Shoot, shoot. Adam Lahem, 23 years old, is, or was at the time of this writing, being held on $40,000 bond on a charge of child abuse resulting in death and criminal negligence. God Almighty, what a sad story. But don't worry. I hope the National Rifle Association isn't worried. This is just one of those tragic accidents. Tragic accident. It'll be called a tragic accident if it hasn't already. When in fact you cannot ascribe the word tragedy to a 3-year-old. You just can't if you know what the word means. We've been over this. It's just a tragic accident here in America because, well, we've got to have firearms and we've got to be able to take them from Kansas to Colorado at Christmas time or else we're not free anymore. That 5-year-old's plenty free, isn't he? Yeah, plenty free. It's just the price we pay for freedom, just like we paid it on Omaha Beach and the Alamo and at Bunker Hill and in an apartment complex in Lakewood, Colorado, where a little five-year-old feller paid for America's freedom with his life. Somebody start up the national anthem. Somebody get me some Toby Keith music playing. Because we still have this sick masturbatory fantasy that having a pistol somehow makes us free. When all it does is make sure that another installment payment will be made on our satanic butcher's bill that supports the gun industry. And the sad thing is, there's something on the order of one of these stories a week. The suicide rate for gun owners is much higher than it is for non-firearm owners. So I've read. But there's all kinds of... Ian Millhiser, writing over at Think Progress today, noting that North Carolina is one of the few states in the country with public records of who has a permit to carry a concealed firearm. You know, I like to make sure that I take old Betsy with me when I go for a loaf of bread, because you never know when the federal government's going to come down and put its iron-heeled boot on your neck, and you've got to be able to defend your Second Amendment rights when you're standing there in the grocery store with that loaf of bread and a jar of Jiffy peanut butter in your hands. You drop the peanut butter and you reach back and you say, "No, federal government, you're not going to get my freedoms today." North Carolina is one of the few states in the country with public records of who has a permit to carry a concealed firearm. And as a consequence, it provides a rare window, Millhiser writes, into how such permits are handled once their holder's criminal record proves them unfit to carry a hidden gun. Because, see, that does happen. You can be a perfectly law-abiding citizen with a concealed carry permit, and then you screw up and you get yourself charged with a felony. And then your right to keep an arm bears is supposed to go away, along with your right to vote and all that. Right. Because you got a debt to pay to society, right? Because this is America, and we pay our debts. Debts to society. And make sure to private prison complexes we got to feed their gaping maw, right? Right. But the data out of North Carolina are something less than inspiring. Terrifying might be an appropriate word. Over a five-year period, the five-year period that was analyzed by the person who pulled these files, over that five-year period, there were more than 2,400 felony convictions among permit holders. Convicted of felonies or misdemeanors, excluding traffic-related crimes over the five-year period, newspaper doing the investigation, namely the New York Times, found that when it compared databases of recent criminal court cases and licensees, either felony or misdemeanor convictions among concealed carry permit holders. 200 of them were felonies. Okay. 10 of them were murder or manslaughter felonies. And of the 10 murder or manslaughter felonies, all but two of the killers, 80% then, used a firearm. Of the 200 felony convictions, those in a position to do so, who are supposed to protect the public safety, failed, according to the New York Times investigation, failed to revoke or suspend the concealed carry permit holder's concealed carry permit. That includes cases of rape, of murder, and of kidnapping. I don't know about you, but that makes the little hair stand up on the back of my neck and my blood run cold. So much for that NRA argument about, these are good, God-fearing, upstanding Christian American patriots who are carrying these concealed weapons, and they're doing it to keep our communities safer. Tell that to the victims of the rapes, the murders, and the manslaughters that involved the firearms. Charming, isn't it? Here's an added little in the punch bowl. North Carolina is one of 20 states where once you have your concealed carry permit, you can then buy all the firearms you feel compelled to own and never have another background check. Because apparently when you're convicted of a felony in North Carolina, you're not required to surrender your... son, do you have a concealed carry permit? Yes, Your Honor, I do. Well, good for you. Not. Well, hand it over, son. We're going to have a little ceremony right here. We're going to tear it into a million little pieces, and we're going to set fire to it right here in the courtroom. And there goes your right to carry a concealed weapon. Now, don't let me catch you doing that, son. God almighty. But it's more important that we sacrifice a few people's lives to convicted felons in possession of firearms who can show a piece of paper that says they have, oh, it's from a concealed carry permit. It's more important that we sacrifice a few people here and there, you know, the 5-year-old here, the 27-year-old the woman there, you know how it goes. Because that's how we protect our freedoms. Where would we be without the freedom to keep an armed bears? Oh, where would we be? Well, we wouldn't be. We'd probably be like them European socialist nations that ain't got no freedom. You know, Germany and Italy and France and Spain, Portugal and England and Sweden and Norway and Denmark and Hollandaise and Finland and. Oh golly gee, and them Czechs and them Australians there near Germany, and because they ain't none of them free, you see, because they can't strap one on and go get them a loaf of bread and a jar of Jiffy. That's the true definition of freedom, being able to strap on a 9mm with an extended capacity magazine. And drive on up and get you a few gallons of gas, maybe a 6-pack of beer, and a loaf of bread and a jar of Peter Pan. And it's out of these things that come horror stories. Meanwhile, the National Rifle Association continues to press something called the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. That piece of legislation, as Ian Millhiser notes over at Think Progress, recently passed the House of Representatives. The Republican-controlled, that's right, House of Representatives wants to extend full faith and credit to a carry permit. So that, let's say, if you've got a carry permit from Alabamistan, then it has to be recognized as legal and you can march down the streets of New York City with it strapped on as long as you got your Alabama right to carry permit. Because, you know, it's important that we have full faith and credit to the laws of this nation among the states of this nation, right? I mean, we wouldn't want any states' rights interfering with the... No, hell no! States ain't got no rights to say who can carry a gun and who can't. and where they can carry it, and whether it can be under a jacket or strapped on right there just like Marshall Dillion, you know, walking down Broadway. On the other hand, we can't, for the life of us. I mean, can you imagine looking at a teabagger and saying, "Yeah, I think you're right there, buddy. We need full faith and credit for concealed carry permits. And we'll get behind that bill just as quick as you decide that people who live in Iowa, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey, New York, who happen to be in a marriage in which their spouse is of the same gender, as quick as you acknowledge that that marriage will be given full faith and credit in Mississippi, Stan, we'll get right on your concealed carry permit." And the little teabaggers' heads would start a wobbling and a shaking, and they'd get the trembles all over, and probably get all Ron Paul. Dear God, there's a Ron Paul story out that we're finding out a little bit more every day what a moron that man is. His former, basically, chief of staff was hoping to clear the air a little bit about what Ron Paul is and ain't, and offered up a bit of an essay about Ron at a site called Right Wing News. The guy's name is Eric Dondero. He is at present being savaged by the Romulans. That's the word for them. I learned that today. They're called Romulans. I thought it was pretty obvious that Ron Paul was a Ferengi, but no, he's a Romulan. Eric Dondero is trying to writes this piece in which he tries to explain, well, you know, Ron Paul's just this old guy, and you know how it is with old guys and gay people. Yeah. So, in the course of that, he tells the story of Ron Paul being in San Francisco, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, Ron Paul and Dandero in San Francisco. Shaka when the walls came down. Star Trek reference for the evening. That's our second or third, isn't it? Jim Perrone was the owner back in 1988 of a store called Laissez-Faire Books in San Francisco. And he set up a three-day campaign swing for Ron Paul through the San Francisco Bay Area to, gin up and huckster up some dollars. So they went from event to event, Eric Dondero says. And at one point they wound up, the whole time they were using the man who set this all up, Jim Perrone. They were using his home office as a base of operations. The first time they walked into the house, Ron Paul pulled Eric Dondero aside and said, "I need you to find some excuse to get me out of here so I can go to a McDonald's or a Carl's Jr. or something so I can use the bathroom there."
"He's got a perfectly good bathroom over here, Congressman Paul."
I didn't ask you if he did. I ain't gonna go to no bathroom in no queer's house. There's all kinds of stuff in there. I might go in there to take a tinkle and come out of singing show tunes. That's how you catch it, you know. I'm a doctor. I'm Dr. Ron Paul. And let me tell you, that gay is catching. Now, I like Jim just fine, but I ain't a-using his bathroom. Just do what I say now.
Like I said, it's not like we don't have the material for Moran Tuesday. don't want to use no homo privy. What happens in the morning if I get up and I come in here and I got to sit down for a little bit and reach over and look for some reading material and there ain't nothing but homo books? You know it takes me a while to get takes my colon a little while to get going. I don't want it. You got to get me an. I'll go to Carl's Jr. I'll just say I like their coffee a whole lot or something. I'll go down there whenever I gotta go to the spring. Oh Jesus. That's not a joke. That's not me. No, that's not fun. That's not goofy old Bob just making crap up. This is Day in the Life with Ron Paul. Looney. And then there's another, and thanks, by the way, to David from Maine for finding these, sending them along. A website called Outside the Beltway. Stephen L. Taylor writing there. Ron Paul, not so much denial back in the 1990s, plus Newsletters 101. 1995, Ron Paul Survival Report. Yeah, I also do an investment letter. It's called the Ron Paul Survival Report, which is a gold-oriented newsletter, but it's also expressing concern about surviving in this age of big government. Yeah.
And as we get started, I'd like if you could give us tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and your experience. Thank
okay.
you.
Just as an aside about the book that you referred to, although that book was put together in early 1990s, it has materials from years before that too.
Okay.
The minority views from the Gold Commission report that would have been done about 10 years earlier. Anyway, I'm a physician here in Lake Jackson. I deliver babies for a living, but I also do an investment letter. It's called the Ron Paul Survival Report, and I put that out on a monthly basis.
I've heard of that.
Which is a gold-oriented newsletter, but it's also expressing concern about surviving in this age of big government where there's a lot of taxes, a lot of regulations, and attacks on our personal liberties. I was concerned about this many years ago. Even in 1974, I had a lot of concern about this and advocated some of the things that they're talking about right now.
Did you now, Dr. Paul? Didn't hear any disavowing there, did you? I do an investment letter. It's called the Ron Paul Survival Report. It expresses concern about surviving in this age of big government. Well, it's under the heading of this Ron Paul Survival Report, a special issue on racial terrorism. The Los Angeles and related riots mark... this is June 15th, 1992. So he gave that interview in 1995, fully 3 years after. June 15th, 1992, the Los Angeles... and related riots mark a new era in American cultural, political, and economic life. We now know, if we did not before, that we are under assault from thugs and revolutionaries who hate Euro-American civilization, read White, and everything it stands for, private property, material success for those who earn it, and Christian morality. Yep. All the people participating in the riots in L.A. in the 1990s, atheists, not Christians. Yep, every last one of them, and they were not Euro-American. But the other things that Stephen L. Taylor points out from the newsletters, some of which you've heard before, some of which you have not, are stunning. Let's see. the October 1992 edition of the Ron Paul Survival Report contained a complaint about letting gays, this is a quote, letting gays force their way onto other people's property. And then January 1994. See, the way, you know, I never read those things. I had somebody else was writing them for me, and I'm not that way, and I disavow all that stuff. I've disavowed it, now stop asking me about it. Made a couple of $1 million off of it. Shut up! But it went on over a course of years. It was December 1990 when the Ron Paul Survival Report said that Martin Luther King Jr. was a bisexual pedophile who beat his sex partners, by the way. St. Martin was a world-class philanderer who beat up his paramours. Nonviolence didn't apply in all spheres, I guess. That's December 1990. By January 1994, though, he was really catching on to the gay threat in America. The homosexuals enjoy the attention and pity that comes with being sick. Put it all together and you've got another wave of AIDS infections that you, dear taxpayer, will be asked to pay for. You got that? I don't know about you, but I know people, knew people, who died horribly, miserably, hopelessly of HIV. I know people who struggle with it every day now. And I have never, ever, ever seen one individual afflicted with that horror who enjoyed the attention and pity that came with being sick. Who's the sick person? You know what? He will not. Ron Paul will not, for the very life of him, come clean and tell us who wrote that. All he'll say is, yeah, I never read it. I disavow it. I don't know. And as long it, you know, this is pre-email. This stuff was going out in the mail with postage on it, with facsimiles of Ron Paul's signature at the bottom of the page. At the bottom of a page that says, they enjoyed the attention and pity that comes with being sick. Put it all together and you've got another wave of AIDS infections that you, dear taxpayer, will be asked to pay for. You see, gay men really live only for sex. These men don't really see a reason to live past their 50s. They're not married. They have no children, and their lives are centered on new sexual partners. These conditions do not make one's older years the happiest. Why is it unfair, if the man will not tell us who wrote this filth, why is it unfair for us to simply assume that it is what it says it is, the Ron Paul Survival Letter by Ron Paul? Try explaining to a fundamentalist that there are certain books in the New Testament that, while claiming to be, and I know this is ironic, letters written by Paul, aren't really.
Thessalonians, Galatians, Ephesians. They weren't written by Paul. They weren't ghost-written by somebody for Paul. They were written by somebody claiming to be Paul who wasn't, who were trying to glom on to the status of St. Paul. This is the same damn... Well, no, not really. Because you can at least make the argument that St. Paul was not writing his letters trying to hustle up a buck or 12. This was a million-dollar mail fraud. It went out across state lines and probably across international boundaries as well.
The race wars, the race riots in L.A. tell us that we're in a new kind of America.
Let's see, it was October 1990 when the Ron Paul political report went after Al Sharpton and other black activists for demonstrating at the Statue of Liberty in favor of renaming New York City after Martin Luther King. In the newsletter, it suggests that better names would be Welfaria, Zooville, Rape Town, Dirtburg, and Lazyopolis.
Next time, hold that demonstration at a food stamp bureau or a crack house.
June 1990 issue, the Ron Paul Report, says,
I miss the closet. Homosexuals, not to speak of the rest of society, were far better off when social pressure forced them to hide their activities.
You know, I'm glad that Ron Paul is getting the attention he's getting, because he has flown under the radar with his weird, filthy, disgusting, antisocial, anti-human, misanthropic babblings for far too long. Maybe, if there is any justice in this universe whatsoever, that's all over now. And people can see him for the disgusting piece of trash that he is. Maybe. You hope.
The gays enjoy the pity they get out of being sick. You just figure out a way for me to get out of here, and I'll go down and use the bathroom somewhere else. Do it now. I'm about to bust. I don't want to... God dang it. I never should have come out here to San Francisco. There's probably all the bathrooms is probably all homoed up out here.
Jiminy. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a little break. We'll come back. Your calls, you know the number, 304-658-3333. That's the direct dial number. If you need us to carry the freight on the call, you can dial 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, head on. Email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. This is The Horn.
It was a slow day, and the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows, the bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is a long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo, the way we look to a song, the way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry. Uh-huh. dry wind, and it swept across the desert and curled into the circle of blue. And the dead sand falling on the children, the mothers and the fathers and the automatic earth. These are the days of miracles and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us a snowball. The way we look to us all. Oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracles and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry. It's a turnaround jump shot, it's everybody jump starts. Every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the battling heart. And I believe these are days. Lasers in the jungle, lasers in the jungle somewhere. Staccato signals of constant information. A loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires and babies. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is a long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow mo. The way we look to us all. Oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in the corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry.
Our energy crisis is all around us. It's blowing in the wind. Stop mountaintop removal coal mining and promote clean, green energy. Coal is filthy. Wind is clean and forever.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Nine and a half minutes past the hour. Time to go to the phones in very short order. Spike, our good buddy Spike, writing in. A couple of emails, and then we go to the phones. He says, I just wanted to chime in on Tebow. First, I prayed all week before the game versus New England that Tebow would lose to the Patriots. And I hate Brady, Mr. Uggs, I may add, as a Dolphins fan. Tebow lost. Mr. Uggs dominates. Okay, 50-50 shot, as George Carlin said. Also, Mr. Uggs is a lock for Canton, Ohio. Then the game versus the Bills, who are a hair better than my Dolphins in simple terms. They surpass. I watched the second half. I started to complain out loud during the game about all the blatant holding Denver was guilty of and not called, not to mention the offensive pass interference. Not called when Buffalo almost got its first pick off of Timmy. I said one time, Jesus would not approve of your team's cheating, people. That idiot in the booth doing play-by-play, Jim Nance, the whole time leading up to this bragging, Tim Tebow has only two interceptions on the season, none on the road, ignoring the fact that late in the third he was just 6 of 8 on passing and is last in yards completed. He rarely throws for a good reason. Well, God, he looks like he's spiking a serving a volleyball when he throws a pass. Just, you know, slap the laces and go. Next play, more horrific holding. I scream, Jesus Christ, as Tebow throws. Boom, interception. So much for none on the road, Jim Nance. Then later, right before Tebow's second of 4 interceptions that day, Nance says, as Tebow lines up, if this is a movie, this is the time to cue up the comeback music here. Phil Simms, a great quarterback in his time and very underrated, laughs on Mike. Boom, snap, another interception. Silence from Simms for a few seconds. Maybe cough button.
Lesson learned. Spike Rogan has more pull with the big man than Tebow, evilgelicals, and all the people on AM talk radio who've brainwashed their zombie fans of his, Tebow's greatness. In an ironic twist, think about the clip of Rush on McNabb on ESPN. It's the perfect description of what he and his fans are with Tebow. Ray writing in, regarding the 2012 Mayan thing, there's a group of folks that have that get sexually excited at the thought of the end of the world. That's just sick. This also fits in also with your reference to the popularity of zombie movies. Bob, we do indeed live in interesting times, and oh, that we do. So, Kim writing in, bathroom and Ron Paul. Tell Ron Paul to tie it in a knot. That's what I used to tell my work crew if they weren't pleased with a bathroom issue. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. First time caller.
Oh, yeah, great. Wonderful. And a first name, please?
This is Angela. I'm in the Bronx.
Well, I'm pleased.
Republic of the Bronx.
Here, here. I'm pleased to hear from you.
Well, the funny thing about Tim Tebow is that he's basically proving all his critics right. He can't throw. They had a very unorthodox way of throwing in college, and all the scouts have basically said, well, he's not going to make it in the pros. He got on a lucky streak, and that was it.
Yeah, maybe an excellent tight end or some sort of hybrid fullback-tailback combo. Sure, why not?
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering about all his fans. If they're so committed, why don't they pay attention to Jesus' admonition about praying in a closet?
Yeah, that's the Pharisee thing. He says, behold the Pharisees who go loudly praying in the streets. They have their reward.
Right. All right. Now, as for Ron Paul, Ron Paul is a plagiarizer on top of everything else. I have a book from Barry Goldwater in 1964, Conscience of a Conservative. And give or take a couple of words here and there, that's Ron Paul's program.
Very, very likely, yes. But, of course, he was also under the sway of Lou Rockwell, who makes Barry Goldwater look like Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah, I've read his website a couple of times. I mean, just for laughs. So I guess that a lot of people like Ron Paul because of certain stances he takes. He was anti-war. He was anti-foreign intervention. But this is a person who's also anti-choice. He's foursquare against abortion.
Absolutely. I guess it was Friday, maybe it was Thursday, when I was talking with David from Maine, who had sent along a link to that that thing, that screed that he wrote, and you know, maybe he'll disavow that too, for all we know, about libertarianism and abortion. And just hooting that no woman has the right to control her own body. That libertarian rights, you know, well, they go only so far. Mostly for men.
Right. He's kidding. I mean, and here's a man who we know he wrote that stuff. Why doesn't he take responsibility take responsibility for what he wrote? How hard is that? Isn't that what you teach your kids?
Well, that's what they teach other libertarians. Libertarianism, the very heart and soul of libertarianism and Ayn Randianism, when you get right down to it, is that, you know, we will take personal responsibility for our actions and stand up and deal with the consequences as they come. That's for us. You know, that's for us little people.
Oh, I see. Well, they also don't feel obligated socially to anyone else. I don't understand that thinking. I'm on a chat room with someone else, and he's saying that I don't want to have anybody's responsibility for anybody else's health, and they don't have it for mine. I'm not taking responsibility for your health, but we do have a safety net. They must not believe in the social contract.
No, they absolutely do not believe in the social contract, because in libertarian Ayn Rand world, it's literally dog eat dog. And you know, I was thinking during the break, just because I was so horrified by that story about the 3-year-old and the 5-year-old, you know, Ron Paul would sit there, because he's libertarian, he's for personal freedom, and there's no bigger personal freedom than the right to keep and bear arms. He would, you know, he's okay if we stack up 5-year-olds like cordwood. because that's what we've got. That's just the price we pay for freedom.
Oh, so he's into paying a price with somebody else's life, but
bingo,
he won't have it coming out of his pocket.
The heart and soul of libertarianism is that they're going to have their liberty on somebody else's back. They're nothing if not hypocrites.
Big-time hypocrites. I mean, think about it. They want to revert the world back to where it was in Dickensian England.
Yes.
You know, the place where Marxism started, for the founding reason that Marxism started in the first place?
Yeah, because of industrial capital abuses of working human beings.
Right.
And
think of it as new freedom. It's not. It's a new form of slavery. Ayn Rand, who changed the name from, I forgot, Alicia something or other, I can't recall her name. Here's a woman who basically worshipped or idolized a child killer.
Yes.
As an ideal man. Are you kidding me? A guy whose claim to fame was he kidnapped a banker's daughter, held her out for ransom, and gave her back to the father, killed, dismembered, and tied up with wire, and showed no remorse for it. And this was her ideal man, because he lived for himself. He was above the rules. You got to be kidding me.
Breathtaking, isn't it? And of course, you know, she proved, one, she was a terrible writer, quite possibly a worse thinker. And then, toward the end of her life, she didn't walk. She ran to the ran downtown to the government building to sign up for Social Security and Medicare.
Of course she did. And I watched a interview she had with Phil Donahue on YouTube.
Oh, I've seen that. Isn't that
Phil Donahue asked about her smoking, and she said, "I revealed myself not to catch cancer." Yeah, way to work out, lady, didn't it?
Jesus.
Right.
Oh.
The will of the mind. She's a poor man's Nietzsche. Give me a break.
Oh, and just an awful science fiction writer. Just, it's blue copper. Oh, that. Imagine writing a science fiction book about railroad trains in 1946. Please.
Well.
No vision whatsoever.
The only reason why she's popular, her and Milton Friedman, I know I'm going to get the Milton Friedman freaks out on me now.
No, no, there are no Milton Friedman freaks here.
The reason why she was popular is because at the time she wrote, at the time that F.A. Hayek wrote, the time that Milton Friedman wrote, it was the height of the Cold War. The United States would have taken any kind of propaganda against the Soviets, including her tribe. It would be like if L. Ron Hubbard wrote in the 1950s. Oh, I'm sorry, he did.
Well, it's like a buddy of mine says, say what you will about the Bolsheviks, they at least figured out a way to get rid of Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
And foisted her off on us. Benedict in our chat room is pointing out that Ayn Rand never got government help. She used an entirely different name to get government help. She used her husband's. She filed for all of her government benefits under her husband's name so that she could then maintain some sort of ideological purity. So on top of everything else she is, she's a fraud.
Oh, she's not only a fraud, she's a adulterer. You know about her open relationship with one of her assistants who's still promoting...
The idea of her... there are stories of the idea of Alan Greenspan literally sitting at her feet like some sort of, I don't know, the gimp from Pulp Fiction just fills me with it gives me the willies.
I mean, but think about it. Think of the concept. You're poor Ayn Rand's husband, okay? She comes up to you and says, "I'm going to have an affair with this man who's married already, mind you, and there's nothing you can do about it." Now, I normally don't pick on anybody about their looks, but if I'm Ayn Rand's husband, I'm jumping for joy. Divorce? Hey, I'm out of here. I'll be out of there faster than Mrs. Kobe Bryant.
Oh, man. For a first-time caller, you're hitting all the bells, man.
And then top it off, as the guy tells the story, I forgot what his name is, as the story is told, when he had an affair behind Ayn Rand's back.
Oh, no. That was not okay.
No, it wasn't. She called him out publicly in front of the group, banned him from the group, and smacked him in the face. So much for objectivism and being responsible.
No, she was manifesting her... what is it? Nobility of selfishness. She was being selfish about her spouse.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, okay. Completely consistent. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. All right.
But yeah, that's all of this stuff. You know, I've made the argument time and time and time again that if you really want to see the logical, and many others on this program have as well, if you really want to see the logical extension of people like Ron Paul's thinking and who's that Eddie Munster looking creep up in Wisconsin? Paul Ryan, yeah, mm-hmm. You know their dream state, the joy of their economic hearts is Somalia and Haiti,
and any local prison you want to stick them into. If you want to get a basic understanding of their kind of world, go to any penitentiary in the United States. Go live there and see how they would like being dog on dog. No offense to Rick Santorum, or plain power, might makes right. That's their ideal society.
Yes, it is. I didn't think about it in terms of the prison system, but you're absolutely correct.
All right? That's why objectivism, for all what she puts out there and what the Rand family wants to put out there, can't work. It's even against the principles that Adam Smith had. See, every one of them will quote Adam Smith from the Wealth of Nations, but he wrote an earlier book, the Theory of the Moral Sentiments.
Yes.
Adam Smith surmised that we are naturally social animals. We do have affinity for one another. Something that wouldn't have existed in either Ayn Rand society or Rand Paul Society, or these guys' society. It can't work, and they know better than that.
Well, exactly, and moreover, none of this bears any... You know, they took the word capitalism, and none of this bears any relationship, again, I've said this a million times, to Adam Smith. Nothing in Ayn Rand, nothing in libertarianism bears any relationship to Adam Smith, because Adam Smith... Adam Smith's capitalism, you know, published 1776, Wealth of Nations, is predicated on shared risk. You know, the guy who builds the factory or whatever, the capitalist, has risk involved with the success or failure of his enterprise, and so too does the guy who sweeps up the floor at night. The difference being that the guy who founds it has greater risk than the guy at the bottom. But in the Rand world, the guy at the top has no risk whatsoever. You know, you mentioned Adam Smith here. There's a favorite quote of mine where he writes, "The progressive state is in reality the cheerful and the hearty state to all the different orders of society. The stationary is dull, the declining melancholy." Funny, there's nothing in there about being conservative.
No, conservatism died with Lyndon Baines Johnson's victory in 64. They were dead. What we have here now is the old Confederacy come to life.
Yes.
It's no accident that most of these free market freaks that we see out here are from the old Confederate South. It's no accident.
Because it's the same economy. It's the same economic principles dressed up with, I don't know, a different uniform from gray and sabers.
Right. And they don't want to admit that. They want the same slave economy, except it won't be just black slaves this time. I can even go one step further. It's the same plantation mentality as it was before. Yes, you had blacks at the bottom of the list. But what they don't understand is that the southern aristocrats still wouldn't have had any of these guys in their house in the first place. They're not moneyed. They don't have any wealth. They give the illusion that you're in the club because you're white. That's it.
Yeah.
But you're in the same social strata. just a tad above.
Precisely. And it's, well, the degree to which they are successful, and I guess it was examined to a certain extent in what's the book What's the Matter with Kansas a number of years back, but it needs to be extended more fully into the into the old Confederacy. The real question is how they have such success simply dividing people along lines that are built on hate and founded upon principles of bigotry, prejudice, and racism. When ultimately, you know, none of those, you know, that old guy that you can see if you drive down south, you'll see him. He'll have a get us out of the UN bumper sticker on the back of a, you know, 70 of a 78 Caprice that's rusted through and bondoed over, wobbling down the road with a Bush Cheney 04 sticker on the other side of the bumper. And there's not, you know, he's not in the same class as the power boys of the Republican Party, but they've got him thinking that he's just a minute away from swelling around with the boys at the yacht club. And it's one of the great mysteries and one of the great frauds of the American political experience that they can do that.
Because it's the American dream. As George Carlin said, you have to be asleep in order to believe it.
Right. There's a club and you ain't in.
Right. And these guys are given the hope that one of them may one day belong in that club. Not really. There's a book that I've read. It's called The Illusion of Democracy. I have to find the title of it. But basically, they will let the wealthy will allow a handful of people to integrate with them, only if to keep up the illusion that there is a way of moving up. But otherwise than that, you won't be invited to the same cotillion, you will not be invited to the same places, you won't be on the same boards. And the wealth will transfer from one person to another within the family. I was reading somewhere where how the Hiltons got their money. Alright? The original Hilton wanted to leave his money to the widows and orphans in the Catholic Church. Well, there's a combination for you. Alright? But his son, Baron Hilton, sued, got a judge on his side to decide in his favor. So if not for that judge that judge he basically bribed, who he still has an employee somewhere, we wouldn't hear about Paris Hilton. But yet Paris Hilton, regardless of her lack of education, her lack of class, will still travel among the better society than most of those guys who are good old-fashioned rednecks down there.
Yep.
Okay, Bob, I think I've run out of gas on this one. I'll let you go.
Well, I tell you what, you go refuel and I hope you won't be an only-time caller.
Nope, I'm going to be calling again, sir.
All right, that'll be great. We'll look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
I love getting new callers. And see, that's the beauty of... How can I put this? I love the notion that the horn has been out there and that just somewhere along the way, someone will say, oh, I gotta contribute. And they'll pick up the phone and they'll dial. And it becomes part of the larger universe of ideas and conversation that has been the motivating factor behind all of this. My God, it's inspiring. Hey, welcome to the program.
Happy holidays, Bob. It's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Well, Kevin, how are you?
Fine. I'm in Brooklyn for a little while. Basically, the Chinese would not renew my visa because of that nice little base that was built in Australia to antagonize the Chinese even more.
Oh, so you're responsible? Really? You built the? I'll be damned.
No, but you see, in Chinese, in Asian culture, and it goes in Korean too, they think in groups. And it's like, you know, you have to answer for your country, pretty much. The concept of individuality, especially in China, is still a very foreign thing. You know, often I end up having to answer for my colleagues, as, you know, like, why do all foreigners use their left hand kind of thing?
Oh.
Yeah, it's so.
I remember that letter you sent along a couple of months back, and it sounded like you were experiencing a little of not so much culture shock as culture frustration.
And we still are. It's like, basically my girlfriend and I, she's still in China, unfortunately. You know, she's finishing out her contract because she's not American. She's South African.
And they're not building a base in Australia, right?
Yeah. Basically, and they pretty much have better relations, politically at least.
Sure.
And we do. So she's going to finish out and she's going to come here. We're basically going to get married this spring and then move
on. Congratulations.
Thank you. Move on to the Middle East somewhere. You know, move on to the Middle East. So, you know. I know you don't sound too thrilled about the Middle East, but it's just a case of, as a teacher,
It depends on where you go. I'd say Syria is not a good bet right now, and
exactly.
I wouldn't feel real good about Egypt or Libya either.
No, it's going to either be Qatar, Oman, or if I'm very desperate, Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia has the biggest demand for English speaking teachers. They're all pretty much tax-free, and money is pretty decent, you know, which I definitely need to recoup at this point. But
yeah, good luck. Good luck with the scotch there.
Well, I could do without. Speaking of which, I have to do without for a while because while here, I found out my blood count went very low, and I was in the hospital for 5 days. I was released yesterday.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's a good thing the whole visa thing went off, because I would not want to be in China in this state.
No.
So.
China and the United States have shockingly similar medical systems.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's just the whole... But again, I'm not doubting China's health care system. Probably they're very, but again, the Asian mindset, being sick, you don't get sick. Unless you're like at death's door kind of thing. They would still expect you to, you know, show up to work, even if it's just a lie there to death kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, in this kind of, you need the rest, you know, you need to bed rest.
Right.
You know, it's a big deal if you have bed rest, and in Asia, like, the whole, you don't even get that because your coworkers will be calling you, basically harassing you all the time. And one day, when I was in Korea, the 1 or 2 days I took off, it was such a huge big deal. And basically, they kind of try to intimidate you not to get sick anymore, you know. So as much as they
don't get sick. Stop it. Mind over matter.
Yeah. As much as they have free health care and all that, you know, which is great, you can't rest. You know, because it looks upon it looks as if you're disloyal and all. And another thing with the Mideast, you get more time off, which is needed. Asia, yeah, you can make money, but you have no time off.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Well, but I hope everything does shake out the way you want it to, Kevin.
I hope so too, and thanks a lot. But I have to go into this whole Ayn Rand, our little boy Tebow and all this stuff and get at the core of the problem, which you and I have discussed many times before. It's just Calvinistic.
There we go. Yep.
It's Calvinism. And, you know, at the core of Calvinism is basically, you know, separating yourself from the rest of humanity.
Well, okay. I'm doing well because God likes me. It's the dirty old ancestor of the modern prosperity gospel. or what they refer to as name it and claim it. We've all probably heard Janis Joplin's magnificent rendition of Lord, Won't You Buy Me a Mercedes-Benz.
Yes.
Well, that's the prosperity gospel. I want a Mercedes. I'm going to name it, and in the name of Jesus, I'm going to claim it. Hallelujah.
Exactly. And the thing is, they use it. And this is one line that I can't get into, having Jesus as my personal savior. Okay? Now, the Jesus I read about in the Bible was everybody's savior.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to press religion or anything on anyone, but it's like, you know, yes, I do have my personal faith, and, you know, the God I believe in, okay, he's not an American, and he loves the Muslim, he loves the non-believer, he loves everyone. Equal opportunity. You know, there's this whole personal savior nonsense, and that's what they do. You know, this is when people, this is how, like, people with that mindset try to separate themselves from the rest of humanity and also use it to inflict their power, you know, try to inflict power and basically bully people. You know, that's what they do.
Well,
I'm part of that divinely elect.
Right. When you create that concept of an elect, then, well, I mean, you've put a rent in the entire social, you've rent the entire social fabric, haven't you? I mean, you put a great big tear in it. There's, you know, God likes me, but he likes me better than he does you.
Exactly.
And all the way up the totem pole, so to speak.
Exactly. You know, the funny thing is, and this is why I thank God I'm a New Yorker, you know, because the real plan was for me not to even be here. By this time, I was expecting to fly out to the Middle East today. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But because of this sickness where I was hospital for 5 days, I had to be treated. And thank God I live in New York, where I can always check into Kings County Hospital, which for years had this god-awful reputation. But I said, in order to get a Medicaid card, I'll just do it. But I was amazingly surprised and delightfully surprised. You know, I got, because of my sickness, I got my own room, and, you know, I was treated well. And they, basically, my B12 count is extremely low. Okay, which drew my platelets level low.
Right.
Okay, and I was hospitalized for 5 days, Christmas too, which was...
Oh, yuck.
Yeah, I know. And I was released yesterday. And I was delightfully surprised. I was treated. They diagnosed me. And, you know, the nurses were great. Doctors were great. And, you know, here's the socialized medicine, basically, until this morning. Okay, when I went to go pick up my prescriptions, which were free, okay, and I had to wait for about a good hour because it's very crowded after a 3-day weekend and all, some mealy-mouthed preacher was on Fox Channel, and that's what they had in there, on the video panels, on loudspeaker. So basically,
that's enough to make you sick all over again.
Exactly. And again, it's like, I'm like, wow, I'm in Kings County, you know, like that, the heart of socialized medicine in Brooklyn. Okay. You know, this is where who doesn't have insurance or is in will get treated. Okay, they treat anyone. Okay, people fly into New York just to get treated at Kings County.
Mm-hmm.
And all that just to come up against that. And I was like, oh my God, my bubble just burst.
Yeah.
Just burst. And, you know, if I wanted to make a big stink about it, I could say, well, this is a government hospital. This has no business being on the air. You know? But again, it's going back to that thing, and the thing is, it is hard. The irony is, in this guy's heart of hearts, he wouldn't want a place like King's Family Hospital. It should be privatized.
Right. And right, it turned into a profit machine, by God.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, I'm sorry it's been a while, and I've gone through a lot of drama, as you can well see, and since I wrote in. But there's a reason why I wrote my messages in China, as you well know.
Right.
Or, you know, but you'll probably be hearing from me while I'm still here, hopefully. Not too long, but...
Well, I hope you get to go and do what it is you want to do.
Exactly, Bob. And, you know, I just want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday and a healthy new year.
Thank you, and the same to you and to your beloved still yeah. in China. You just got a note in from Jim saying, a pox on Fox. All my best to your latest latest caller, meaning you. And Jim says, get well.
Thanks, Jim. And also a prosperous new year and hopefully I can be more of a contributor to that in the upcoming year, please. You know, that's what my new year, you know, a prosperous new year for the network. Okay?
Thank you very much, Kevin. And stay in touch and let us know you're okay, all right?
Okay, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Okay. Take care, Kevin.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Back in Brooklyn, that's our buddy Kevin. I've been talking with Kevin for a long, long time now, and I sure do hope he gets to feeling better. As Ron and Raleigh just said, by Jove, that sounds like a song cue. And it is. We'll take a minute, based on what Kevin said. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who cares. Your own personal Jesus, someone to hear your prayers, someone who's there. Feeling unknown and you're all alone. Flesh and...
Yeah, you see what I mean? It just kind of had to happen, didn't it? Just, yeah, a little touch of Mr. John Cash doing a song. I think Depeche Mode originated it. It was covered by Marilyn Manson as well. But it expresses such profound sentiment, your own personal Jesus. And that's, you know, that's what you get with Tebowing in the end zone. I mean, Bill Maher has a point. Was Jesus mad at Tim Tebow the last Saturday? Or maybe he just doesn't go in for football. Maybe he's more of an ice skating guy. Or maybe he doesn't go in for any of that either. You know? Exactly. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, hey, Bob. Happy holidays to you.
Well, happy holidays, Reverbo.
I was just about to write you an email, and look at this. We're on the air.
Isn't it funny how that happens?
God, it's a wiggly world. You know that.
Well, you know, it's chaos, string theory. Yeah, right.
Hey, mystery solved.
Yes?
I can solve that mystery as to why these extreme knuckleheads, these plant these Beauregards and their plantation wives seem to be so successful. And I'll bet everybody knows the answer. And the answer is because they spend so much resources, and it's so easy to keep some of us so
well chumped.
And that's how they do it. Of course, course that's how they do it. And it actually, had you been on the air yesterday, that my moron for Monday was the media. I was just so sick of how they were reporting the all that bullshit that was going on before Christmas with the in the House of Representatives.
Oh God!
I mean, can't we just get along? We're just everybody's loggerheads. We're just there's obstructionists everywhere, and I'm thinking, why are you doing this to people? Why are you misrepresenting what's going on? Even NPR does this. You know, I get on them for this. Why can't you just tell us the truth? You can't even pay the other side.
Well, it's like the PolitiFact Pants on Fire story of the year. I'm sure you saw some of that. The Rude Pundit had a brilliant take on it. PolitiFact prides themselves on fact-checking political statements, and they declared that for the year 2011, Reverbo, the Pants on Fire lie of the year was Democrats claiming that Paul Ryan's plan would end Medicare.
Now, that's a butte.
And it's a crazy assertion because Paul Ryan's plan would end Medicare, because Medicare is more or less a universal health care plan for people 65 and over.
Yeah.
And the Ryan plan would privatize it and turn it into a voucher system, at which point it would no longer be a universal single-payer healthcare system, and it would therefore be ended, right?
Okay.
But PolitiFact had been criticized because it seemed like the only people they were calling out for being a bunch of filthy liars were Republicans. And they never really took a look at the fact that the reason they were calling out Republicans as filthy liars is because Republicans are filthy liars. And instead, they trotted this one out, which is a huge disservice to the country. And it's like it created a sort of philosophical space to operate in that was filled, for instance, Sunday, and repeated again on Monday, I might add, on Press the Meat on NBC. It was repeated on MSNBC, in which a very smug Tom Brokaw on NBC, you know, who I don't know what that is where he can't say the letter L. I had dental work. But
that's what it is. It's dental work. You gotta see Dana Carvey do Brokaw. Priceless.
Oh, that's what I'm ripping off. But how did you know? There's Tom Brokaw, who is, I'm guessing, not ever going to have to worry about Medicare. He's over the Medicare age, but, you know, he can pay cash. And he's sitting there on, talking smugly with David Gregory. You remember David Gregory, right, Reverbo? MC Rove, up there shucking and jiving at the correspondence dinner with Carl Rove, you know, because we're all just buddies here. Well, he's sitting there, Brokaw sitting there bemoaning the fact that the Wyden-Ryan plan to kill Medicare isn't getting more traction. And, you know, I woke up yesterday morning at the same time, you know, never mind whether I'm going to be on that. I knew I wasn't going to be on the air, but I'm still up at, you know, freaking 6 o'clock in the morning, because that's what my internal clock is set to. And I click on the TV, and thinking I'm going, you know, I understood once, you know, for everybody who said, Bob, why do you watch that Morning Joe thing? Well, I understood why I watch Morning Joe now, because in its place was the repeat of Christmas Day Sunday's Meet the Press. And I got to listen to Kathleen Parker explaining that the economy really wasn't important to Americans. She's a Republican, of course. And Tom Brokaw lecturing us dumb old proles about basically that Medicare's just got to die. So yeah, you want to nominate the media for Moran Monday? I'm right behind you with the second brother Reverbo.
How many nominations has the media gotten so far?
I think it's just kind of a rolling one. The only one we grandmothered out was Godzilla from Wasilla. That was just getting too easy.
But I mean, Machiavelli understood this, and Joseph Goebbels understood it, and the Republicans totally understand it, and they practiced that they've got it down to a fine art. The thing that kills me is that the Democrats, they get it. They just won't do it. They just won't do it. They know how you play the game, and they know how you score points, and they just refuse to call those plays. Getting back to your football.
It's kind of an irresistible metaphor, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I don't know what Obama's thinking at the moment. I don't know where he is.
And, you know, as we approach the end of 2011 and the sure to God, God's honest beginning of the real yawning maw of hell that is the 2012 election season, Reverbo, you know, I can't help thinking with the news that came out today that Ben Nelson and that thing that lives on top of his head, he's not going to run for re-election in 2012. Just in time to make sure that it's going to be almost impossible to find a progressive in Nebraska to run in his place, and I don't mean Bob Kerry.
The timing of that was a little bit suspect.
Yeah, well, like I said, he took the money and didn't run. Because he'd already hustled up 400 large from Democratic groups and supporters to help him in his election bid. And now that money's just his, isn't it?
You mean you don't have to pay that back?
I don't think so. And if you've got a war chest when you retire, you get to keep the war chest too, don't you?
What? We have totally picked the wrong careers here.
Oh, it's... No, yeah. You and I, we could be televangelists or politicians or... Right.
Well, we could be... appliance healers is what we could be.
That's what we could, yes, indeed. Have you got? I don't know. Has your hair grown out? Can you get the good? Can you get the good pompadour and the DA going in the back? Because you got to have that to be an appliance healer, Reverbo.
You know, I like you caught something that I had to go back and appreciate that the Cro-Magnon. Sleazeball.
It's the same sleazeball 25,000 years later.
Yes, it's the same branch. That's the branch of that tree.
And just to let people in on this little game of inside baseball, Reverbo has been culling the greatest hits of Gary Larson and the Far Side of late, and we noticed that the appliance faith healer is actually the same guy as the Cro-Magnon man who offers a light to Trina the Neanderthal lady. So, yeah, there's a 25,000-year dot-to-dot extension between the two, and you just go, well, shit, that explains everything.
Pretty much. Just put a suit on the prehistoric one, and there you got it. Get a microphone on the stage.
Yeah, and by the way, Benedict in the chat room confirming for us, Reverbo, Ben Nelson's campaign funds are now simply his bank account. That's the way the law was written by, guess who, the people who would end up with those bank accounts. Duh. What a racket. I mean, this is where you'd run the Yakov-Smirnov clip. What a country.
What a country. That's the big picture point of the whole thing, is that, and let's go back to Thena, you know, is he giving Thena a light at the prehistoric restaurant? Haven't we been having these? This has been the fight ever since we climbed down from the trees, right? The haves and the have-nots have been pretty much at each other's throats. There's nothing new about.
And the haves have been winning. I mean, let's be clear.
Right. Those who own the planet run the planet. Yeah, we get this. Everybody gets this. You know, and corruption in politics. You know, wake me when that's over. That movie's over. We all get it.
Right, and when you contemplate, Reverbo, when you contemplate that, yes, if you're a member of Congress and you've been soliciting campaign funds for, you know, a few years, a couple of decades, and it's all in there to help you run your next campaign, and but there's a law there that says that when you quit, it just becomes your money. Now, let's take a minute and calculate the odds that the people who are existing in that system are ever going to pass a law that changes that system, that gets what we like to call the dirty money out of politics.
I'm going to guess nothing.
Yeah, right. I don't think I don't think there. I don't think that the worst, most rotten luck bookie in London who will bet with you on which bird flies away from a wire next would take that one. Because they're going to. I mean, if you had a dodge like that set up, would you say, you know what, we need to end this? After I retire with the money, we'll end this.
At least, the reason I'm so pissed off at the media, though, is at least that there were, you didn't have to dig and dig and dig. Your audience does dig. You and I dig for the truth, but nobody has time for that. It's funny that the Tea Party, they don't even have, nobody gives a shit about them. Signed on to them are like 200 odd Congress people. I mean, it's just absurd. And the fact that yes, there's politics is corrupt and you know, these fights just go back till the dawn of time. That does not mean, though, that does not somehow validate this equivalency, this false equivalency.
No, they're not the same. They're not the same in the least.
Boehner, like, he actually had a little press conference where he said, well, I don't know, maybe y'all could come back, the Senate could sort of come back, we'd talk about this some more. Hey, Chief, there's nothing to talk about. Everybody's left. You got the ball.
Right, well, and that's precisely the question I asked. Is there anybody out there silly enough to think that had anybody taken Boehner's bait, that the Republican House would not have attached a rider to any proposed bill that said, in addition, Barack Obama must stand on one leg with his left hand in the air, he's got to sing, I'm a little teapot short and stout. No, I'm a little communist, Muslim, anti-colonial teapot short and stout.
There you go. You can't have there is no when it comes down to it anymore. There's one story, there's one narrative, and there's one, you know, way to fix things that's right, and really the other 99 ways are wrong. And the media is just not that. It's just so sad what's happening here, because people walk away thinking they just get a little piece of this, you know, when they're buying snow tires, and a little piece of this at Walmart. And I guess too many people are getting a big old piece of this on TV at dinner time. They're getting the idea that, you know, yeah, both sides are just, they just can't seem to agree with anything. And they're not getting they have no sense of anything, of any context or any history or anything anymore. They just, you used to be able to have a debate. Okay, maybe it was a manufactured debate. But people used to be able to, you know, talk about, like, what is the function of government? You know, what's an appropriate role for the private sector and the public sector and all this kind of stuff? And now there's simply no debate anymore. There's nothing.
No, because on the one side, you've got the Democrats who are always eager to compromise, because they actually do, for all their failings, have some conceptual appreciation of the meaning of governing.
Yeah.
And they are arrayed against the Republican Party, whose response to anything that isn't precisely their way is to call you a boogerhead.
Exactly.
And there's really nothing, you know, there's no way to find common ground in the space between those two positions, Reverbo.
No, there isn't. There is no discussion. I mean, and that's what's happening. I do think people are walking around just sort of in this kind of huge hallucination of denial. I'm just wondering what the hell's going to happen.
Well, let me offer you, since we're talking about the media, and we know where the media get their ideas, right? They get their ideas from blast emails and little linkies sent around from the incredibly effective right-wing Republican machine. Agreed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I get up this morning, and I've got one of those, and we've talked about them before, one of those multitudinal, ubiquitous, weird right-wing interview pitches. And in this case, I am supposed to bring on a guy named Dan Holler, who is the communications director for Heritage Action for America. He's a Heritage Foundation punk, okay?
And that really is his last name.
Holler, yes. Yep, I can't make it. There's some stuff that's just beyond me, Riverboat. So he closes out this column called $40 and a Smart Car, in which he argues that the Democrats were lying when they said that the money saved from the payroll tax hike would meant a fridge and pantry full of groceries or a full tank of gas. And he goes to great pains to point out that sure, you could buy a full tank of gas in a Mini Cooper or a Honda Fit or a Hyundai Accent or a Smart Car or a Toyota Yaris. Sure, but who wants to drive those cars? No, really. But then he closes it all out by offering the right-wing take on what you're talking about with, you know, the Republicans coming back and signing on and to the deal for 2 months.
2 months.
Yeah, and he said 2 months. And he says, most observers understand the White House is engaged. Most observers, mind you. Most observers. That includes me, you, everybody listening in the... Most observers. That's a word meaning 51%, right? More than not. Most observers understand the White House is engaged in a high-stakes game, seeking to gain a political advantage at the expense of so-called Tea Party extremists. If President Obama calls on Harry Reid to come back and negotiate a one-year extension of the payroll tax cut, among other things, he loses the ability to demagogue conservatives. Americans have given up hope that things will change in Washington and are no longer surprised by the misleading and desperate rhetoric peddled by the White House. God, this reads like something you would expect to come out of, you know, the old PAS or Pravda or Izvestia or maybe the modern Pyongyang Daily, right?
Yeah, it's exactly what we're talking about. It's perfect. These people have it down to an art.
They just offer it up there as God's honest and unfly-blown truth.
Well,
and the media takes it. The media take it and just run away with it and offer it as truth.
Well, their blowtorch takes it. That was back in the opening of our call here. You keep people stupid, and then you just blast them with this bullshit. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of the kids that I went to school with. I don't think any of them. If you went to school in the '60s, or maybe I don't know. I don't know if you're buying into. If you can be bamboozled like this. I had civics class, and I had social studies, and I had teachers in high school that really made us think. I had shit like essay tests, man. You remember those?
Oh, yeah, surprisingly, I did my best on those.
Well, the teachers that gave you those, it took you a while to understand how inspiring these men and women actually were and were going to be in your life. That's why it wasn't...
Because it takes... You know, it takes a little dedication to sit down and read a bunch of essay tests, as opposed to just putting the little holes punched out key over the multiple guess test and saying, "Oh, there's a D," and "Oh, no, that was A," and yeah, big difference.
But just like we can remember what a good job is, and we can remember what benefits are, and what a decent wage was. You know, I can also remember what Walter Cronkite was. I can also remember what the Fourth Estate was. I can remember Woodward and Bernstein. And anymore, I just don't think people can remember jack shit.
I can't remember who won Dancing with the Stars last year or who the American Idol was. And in this country, that is more important than being able to remember who Woodward and Bernstein were, because that is what drives what passes for conversation anymore. You and I are rather famous, I suppose, for our little digressions. And it's the absence of teaching civics. It's also the absence of what happened after the end of the Second World War when the front porch went bye bye. You know, when the entry to the house became a pair of concrete steps up to a concrete platform that was 4 feet wide in front of the front door of the house. Because all of a sudden, having somewhere to hang out in the shade in the evening, that went away.
Yeah, it did.
And consequently, so did the conversations that took place there.
Very true. And of course, then we had, and both parents had to eventually go to work to make the salary that one parent was making. You know,
precisely.
20 years before then, and so nobody's home to talk about anything. And so, you know, I guess it's just time to, you know, fire up that joint and play video games in the basement. And these are the people that are in charge.
Hey, we got any more Cheetos? Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know. But, yeah, I was just so pissed at the way they were misrepresenting what was going on with that whole bill. Totally misrepresenting.
Yeah, the way the for-profit media offered it, of course, the Republicans were acting in good faith. They weren't trying to hold the nation hostage or anything. They just have a different vision of a vision of small government.
That's right. But I have friends with brains, and the people who listen to your show, have brains. And we used to be able to talk about, I mean, I have people who I respect. I have friends who are more on the conservative end of things. They don't like particularly, you know, we can have a discussion about whether or not something's a handout or whether or not, you know, just how much help the government should you know, offer people, just how compassionate should government be, and how do you, you know, what incentives should there be, you know, you can have these really interesting discussions. Now, of course, you cannot. You know, there's a handful of people who can talk about this kind of stuff. And so all that's gone by the wayside. Okay, forget all that.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, it's a little bit depressing because you're telling me that the audience size of the horn is never going to grow much.
Well, maybe so. All right, before I hang up, I've got this condensed into one question. Here's the question, right?
Okay.
When are the Democrats? I don't know what the progressives are doing. I don't know what Bernie Sanders is doing. The question is, when are the Democrats going to start manipulating the chumps?
Never. That would be dishonest. We wouldn't want to do that. That would be playing dirty.
Well,
never.
Okay.
I mean, look, we tried to explain to people what Paul Ryan wanted to do to Medicare. PolitiFact. They said it was a liar pants on fire moment. We wouldn't want to do that.
Obama should be on the air every single weekend, making sure everybody knows the names of these people who just essentially want to crush him and crush you.
Yeah, why? Do you remember? Was it Mitch McConnell or was it Jim DeMint? No, Jim DeMint was destroying health care would be Obama's Waterloo, but it was Mitch McConnell who said our goal, our primary goal, our only goal is to make sure Barack Obama does not get a second term. Why are there not trucks going through neighborhoods with speakers on them just playing, so to speak, metaphorically, just reminding people of that? Because all you have to do is hear that and it explains every last piece of legislation that has every anti-abortion,
it's not as if there's a dearth of material.
I mean, Jesus, you know? they adjourned. The first time the House adjourned, they didn't have time to take up the issue of continuing unemployment and the issue of the payroll tax cut. And, there are those who make the cogent arguments that continuing to cut the Social Security tax is not a good idea. But you know what they did have time for, Reverbo? They had time to stand up for a great American.
Winston Churchill?
Yeah! You know, because that communist Muslim Obama with the anti-colonialist sentiment, he there was a bust of Winston Churchill in the Oval Office, and he done sent it back to England. And so the Repiglican House of Representatives, who would be more than willing to watch the entire economy of the United States absolutely burn to a crisp, found time, instead of dealing with real business, they found time to order that a statue of that great American, Winston Churchill, be placed in the capital of the new United States of America.
Are these people begging to be put out of their misery? They've been begging since 2000. They're serving themselves up on the proverbial platter. You're right. We should have this just blaring from. Well, what kind of cars would the progressive Democrats be using? I guess the hybrid electrics or something. Just blaring in every neighborhood on every weekend. Just all these quotes. Just there's a ton of them. All this lunacy.
It's all over.
McConnell's wrong, of course. They sort of failed. You don't really see anyone beating Obama, do you?
It's hard to imagine, and you know, I sort of had it brought home to me today, just by way of Twitter and a reminder. The fact of the matter is, we are all mesmerized at a cheesy magic act of sorts, Reverbo. We're watching this clown car act of the Republican presidential effort. While the real effort is being that's being made on the part of the GOP is getting the Senate, and that just fills me with a form of dread that's virtually inconceivable. With all apologies to Wallace Shawn, I mean, as loony as the House of Representatives is, and I think we can say that it's been loony, can't we?
Oh, we can.
Wacky, daffy, screwball.
I don't see any need for any sort of phony fairness about it. I think it's clearly those people have gone bye-bye.
Well, imagine what happens when a not much of a Democrat in the first place, but at least his vote counted toward calculating the majority in the Senate, like Ben Nelson. Imagine what happens when he gets replaced by a Republican. Imagine a Senate race in Virginia where George Allen, Makaka, defeats Tim Kaine for an open seat. You know, the one that James Webb is vacating. Imagine any number of other Senate races here in the United States. And you don't have to imagine very far before you get to 51 Republicans. Because, see, the Republicans, Reverbo, insisted that we have 60 to pass any legislation. The Democrats needed 60 votes to take a break to go potty. But if the Republicans have 51 votes, they will rubber stamp everything that comes from that lunatic house and send it to Barack Obama's desk. And so even if he wins by some sort of a landslide, it's still 4 years of more ineffective toilet swirling. The Senate is where I hate these metaphors, and you know it, Reverbo, so I'll apologize. The Senate is where the war is. Now, I'm sure there's some, well, you know, I mean, Romney could beat him. And I guess he could. But And yeah, that's terrifying. Lunatic House, lunatic Senate, magic underwear president. That's.
Mm-hmm. But the scary part, where you're going, is you don't need the president to really screw mess things up.
No, they'll just put the finishing touches on by taking the Senate. And let's say, let's take Solyndra. Just as a little, for instance, Reverbo. Can you imagine a House of Representatives with a tidy majority and a Senate with 54, or God knows, if 60? 60 Republicans in the Senate? How long would it take for impeachment hearings to start over Solyndra?
Not long.
No. And it's 4 years of that. And it's 4 years of the economy in absolute chaos. And it's 4 years of no job creation. And it's 4 years of... how long would it take a Republican Senate and a Republican House to extend the Bush tax cuts forever, Roberto?
I don't know why... This is not making this evening delightful.
Sorry. Yeah, I am. I'm being undelightful, aren't I?
Yeah, well, you're singing to the choir. Yeah, 4 years is more of an either inertia or circling the drain. The problem is, at some point, you're going to go down the drain. I don't think we...
Yeah, because, you know, that whole... anybody who's ever watched the water go around the toilet knows that the water gets faster. It builds momentum. And that's where we are. And God knows if there is a Republican Senate, it may very well violate the laws of physics with the speed it generates.
Yeah, the smoke screen idea. This is scary. Well, and of course it is a carpool of clowns. So it can't possibly... I mean,
Jesus, look at the reality. In Virginia, they're going to have a Republican primary that has two names on it. Mitt Romney and Ron Paul.
Well, evidently. Well, say, back up a minute. What's the story with Webb? How come he isn't...
I guess maybe he just didn't like it anymore.
Wasn't he just a first-termer?
I think... Was he a first-termer?
Did he get in four or six?
Bob.
He's that military guy, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, he was a Republican Secretary of the Navy under Reagan for about 6 months and then went, ooh. No, it can't be 12 years. No, there's no way. He's a first-termer and he's walking away.
Well, that's interesting.
No stomach for the fight, maybe. I don't know.
Well, Elizabeth Warren looks like putting up quite a squawk in Massachusetts, but...
But that'll just be Massachusetts returning to normal, and frankly, November is a long time away, Reverbo, a very long time. So, I mean, there's a lot... there's a lot of this going on. I mean, Indiana, what's his name, Richard Lugar, who has been a pillar of what you and I used to regard as... the normal, semi-normal Republicans, that guy's in trouble because he's being run at in his own primary by the Republican treasurer of Indiana, who is a teabagger. May you live in interesting times, you know?
Well, you do, and again, I can't quite wrap my head around this idea that a this totally contrived political... entity, the Tea Party, which now really has there's no real followers of this, except in Congress. It's almost, I mean, if it wasn't so scary and serious, it'd just be laughable. Like, boy, did they sign on with the wrong team.
But they're true believers. And let's never forget that. And the teabaggers have not gone away. You know, Judson Phillips is a hotshot lawyer, multimillionaire lawyer out of Nashville, and he's the one who set up the teabagging convention at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel there on the river in Nashville. Where Sarah, remember the one where Mussolini read off of her hand or whatever it was?
Yeah.
He sent out an email. He sent out an email today, or a week or so ago. I'm sorry. This is the lunacy. Just listen to this, okay? Because to describe it would be to fail. This is a real live, no, Bob did not make this up, real live email from teabagging generalissimo Judson Phillips to the faithful.
This incident with Iran getting one of our top-secret military drones, comma, has been puzzling me since it happened. It's vaguely... I mean, this is straight out of the John Birch Society, okay? It's vaguely reminiscent of the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden with no evidence shown to the American people. Personally, I think he's been dead since around 2003, have seen no evidence otherwise, and think Obama staged the incident just so he could take credit. People prove they're alive by showing up, and he hadn't shown up in any way in years. But we've been hearing reports recently that socialists and gangs, have been infiltrating our military now. So this leaves two very disturbing possibilities left. The grammar is a joy. I mean, this, it really, I said this Friday night, I think, you know, behold the coelacanth. This is, so this leaves two very disturbing possibilities left. One, that Obama passed down direct orders through a trusted chain of command to land this drone in Iran, possibly sparking a war with Iran, and handing over our top-secret military technology to them and their Russian and Chinese allies. Or it may have been the act of a lone traitor who was operating the drone and decided to do this act on their own. You know, a lone traitor acting on their own. This guy's a lawyer. Both are very disturbing possibilities and should be investigated, but who will do that? At least such an investigation should be called for. Demanded.
No other way. We have to have an all-out investigation of this.
And Michael Hain, writing at Addicting Info, says, of course, and Gaddafi is actually working for George Soros, and global warming is just God's morning breath.
God, the head just spins, stuff like that. There you have it. There you have it. There's the...
The teabag is alive and unwell.
It is alive, but it doesn't pull very well. I mean, it's not as if it was the majority of people do not in any way identify with it. But I'm glad to see your Congress does. I feel a lot better. God, I mean.
You know what I'd do if I were you? I'd just get on the road and go up there to the Pennsylvania line, get me a bowl of that cream of crab soup, and have done with it.
I'm going to have to do that at some point. Maybe take someone, go up there in somebody's 530XI.
Oh, that would be a lovely little drive.
But I'll just offer to buy and in exchange for being behind the wheel.
You know what? I think that would be a lovely bargain.
Yeah.
Isn't there a Christmas carol that has a line about, and we'll pretend that it's the Autobahn? No, that's not it.
All right. You have a happy new year. I'm, for one, I'm extremely excited about this, the Mayan prophecies, and I'm looking for almost all of them to show themselves. I think that's all of our problems.
It would do that. It would do that. Reverbo, you have a happy new year as well. You and all of yours, and just take care and make it personal as you go into this new year. And just remember that there's no such thing as a new year anyway. So what the hell?
All right. Well, make it personal. Back to you, and I'll catch up with you on the flip flop.
All right. Keep the shiny side up and the dirty side down.
Keep your stick on the ice.
All right. Later, Reverbo.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
That's our op-ed columnist at headonradionetwork.com. That's the inimitable Reverbo. That's a bit of a nickname. Reverbo the human boy. Because God knows sometimes it feels like we're at the circus. And we go onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, how you doing?
Hey, Jim, how are you?
Not a whole lot. All I can say is that 2012, it would appear to be an annus horribilis.
It has all the earmarks of it, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, you don't have to look to the Mayan calendar for a lot of devastation or whatever. Because a lot of devastation has been going on a long, long time.
I know. That's the thing about the whole Mayan calendar prophecy thing.
You just want to look at people. Focus. We've got real problems over here. Just focus. Look this way.
Well, Bob, if the Mayan calendar is true, we won't have to worry about any of that.
Absolutely. It just, I don't know.
You know, that'll be it. The Earth will align with the planets and shift and do all this kinds of stuff. There's a movie called 2000.
Yeah, I don't think, I don't think this is the age of Aquarius stuff where love will steer the stars anymore, is it?
No. The fifth dimension is, I enjoyed them greatly, but I'm afraid they are confined to the dustbin of CD history. So it's a very nice song to listen to.
Oh, yes. But, you know, you mentioned, with the Mayan stuff, it always puts me in mind of that little, very short poem by Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire, but if I had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
Well, it's not the first time that ice has engulfed this planet.
No.
I know that from the stuff that the geologists and the archaeologists and the paleoarchaeologists have told us and what they found. And, you know, as I said before, things are in a state of flux. They always have been. Nothing stands still. And unfortunately, it would appear to me as though, and here again I say, two things. First, the forces driving this country are K Street and Wall Street. And second, that time is secular. It's not linear.
Well, I agree. I agree on both fronts, and that's why I said to Reverbo what I did. Namely, can you imagine the politician who would vote to end a sweetheart system that lets him keep what's left in his war chest when he quits? It's counterintuitive, to say the very least, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. You were referring to whom now? I'm sorry. I was trying to...
Well, in the particular case at hand, it's Ben Nelson, allegedly Democratic senator from Nebraska. This is the guy who helped kill the Employee Free Choice Act, among other things. And so far, in what was anticipated to be his tough campaign against a Republican challenger, this is a Republican attorney general from Nebraska, who compared welfare recipients to coons, called them coons, no kidding. How you could have a tough challenge from that guy, I don't know. You know, you just nickname him so-and-so Coon Johnson, and, you know, it's the old LBJ thing about, yeah, I just want to hear him deny it. But Ben Nelson had raised $400,000 from various and sundry Democratic groups before he decided that he would call it a day, and having called it a day, he will get to keep his entire war chest and go home with it. Not a bad racket, really, is it, Jim?
Well, you know, money talks. Always has. And, you know, if there's money, people are attracted to it, and they will sell their souls for it.
It is the truth.
I mean, really, they have no compunction about so doing.
But in all truth, the presidential campaign will, of course, it has its own gravitational force, and it'll draw a lot of attention. But I'm not kidding when I say that I think that the Republican Party is savvy enough to absolutely delight in the notion that we will all focus our attentions on the presidency while they go about the business of taking the Senate. Jim, can you conceive of 2 years, if not four, or maybe six, in which not just Republicans, I mean, we're not talking about the Eisenhower Republican Party, in which these crazy, hair-on-fire weirdos just send bill after bill after bill after bill, and every one of them crazy as 4 o'clock, onto the president's desk, daring him to veto. Because that gives me the look for a soft place to land sense.
Well, basically, you have a dislocation of the balance of power. And what they're going to do is try to dislocate any executive authority there ever was. And, you know, I don't mean to negate it necessarily, but to dislocate it. I think that's their strategy, really.
Would you put impeachment past them?
Well, they tried it before. I mean, they tried to impeach Bill Clinton. They tried to impeach Andrew Johnson because Andrew Johnson was not in line with Thaddeus Stevens.
Yep.
And, of course, I can remember when Bill Clinton was in his hour of woe, the House managers walking into the chamber looking like stormtroopers and with all these nasty smiles on their faces or grimaces and things like that. It's as if they were just the greatest thing in the world and were beyond any type of reproach. And we've seen how many of those people who marched into the House of Representatives for the combined session of Congress to try to impeach Bill Clinton, you know, what hypocrites they are and what hypocrites they were. I mean, it just made me sick.
Oh, Asa Hutchinson and Lindsey Graham.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've never seen people with such a false sense of, what can I call it? Normally I'm not in a lack for words, but tonight I am. It's just basically some type of P.T. Barnum act. It's exactly what.
And frankly, I would not put it past them, not in the least, not for a moment, to try it again.
Oh, yeah, they probably will.
Because Newt Gingrich was all for it when it happened. Remember, he was banging his intern Callista like a cheap gong, at the same time that Bill Clinton was being dragged through the mud.
And so many of them else were.
Sure.
I mean, I'm certain they couldn't pass any type of.
And do you think John Boehner would have the backbone to stand up and say, "Well, no, we're not going to do this." No, hell no. Eric Cantor would take the bit in his teeth and run.
You know, I hate to say this, but I wish that J. Edgar Hoover was still alive, because if he had his files the way he did on other people, he, you know, someone like him could bring some of these people to heel. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
In an offhanded sense,
for instance, you remember, you probably ran across that story a few days ago about Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin referring to, saying that the First Lady had a large posterior.
Well, so what? I mean,
well,
you know,
yeah, so what indeed. But today I was wandering around over at BartCop.com, Jim, and Bart had a picture of Jim Sensenbrenner. Now, this guy makes Sidney Greenstreet look svelte.
Oh, my Lord. He is a big boy. As a matter of fact, I saw two films with Sidney Greenstreet, The Maltese Falcon and another one today. And unfortunately, at least Sidney Greenstreet contributed a great deal to his actions on the screen. And these people who talk about the derriere of Mrs. Obama, I mean, you know, hello, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
And you know, I think back to the Bush years, the W years, and there were a lot of things said, and there was a lot of fun had, and a lot of mockery and so forth. But I don't recall anybody ever referring to Laura Bush's posterior. I mean, really? That's where these right wing gas bags are now?
Unfortunately, Bob, people have a way of sinking to their lowest common denominator. They really do. And they will pull out everything and everything they can to demean, to make fun of, and to completely dehumanize a person because of their physical appearance. And I can't think of any one of these people who are casting aspersions about Mrs. Obama. And I'm not going to say the First Lady, because Jacqueline Kennedy had it right. The name First Lady sounds like the name of a damn horse. But, you know, I can't think of anything that these people are casting aspersions on upon which they are themselves either guilty or archetypical. I mean, they really are. And the whole thing can be characterized in one word, and it's just very tacky. It's ugly. And, you know, I just, when I look back over the past 30 years and I see what has happened since 1980, it has not been good.
No, it's been a matter of very identifiable decline, hasn't it, Jim?
I would think so. I mean, we have lost any sense of civility, any sense of decency, and people will do anything they can to gain for not any length of time, but just for a moment, their 15 minutes of shame, not fame, but shame.
Well, consider
their own position in the media, you know?
And again, I go back, for instance, the people who are supporters of Ron Paul. There is nothing you can say to them that will make them, they have no shame, that will make them think that he is anything but some sort of saintly oracle.
Well, you know, he disavowed those statements. He says he never wrote them, so, you know, that's the end of it. Why does the liberal media keep bringing it up?
Well, we keep, you know, people keep bringing it up, Jim, because it is so manifestly hateful, and because he won't address its reality.
Because it's true. He did see those things went out under his name. And as I said before on this program, you know, he can't disavow that. He said it. He did it. And he put his name under it. And for someone to say, oh, no, I didn't, but, sir, yes, you did.
Is this your signature?
The only thing I can say to that is, sir, have you no sense of decency?
Well, for, you know,
you know, just like that attorney before the McCarthy hearings, who played the part in Otto Preminger's film, Joseph Welch.
Yes.
He finally confronted Roy Cohn and Joseph McCarthy when McCarthy tried to smear that lawyer. You know, have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? At least back then, there was some type of reaction from the public that could respond to this type of thing and realize what McCarthy and Cohn were trying to do, and what they were trying to do to the freedoms that were basically written into our Constitution, and to ruin people's lives and to destroy careers because of their past associations with agitprops or communist front organizations. And by the way, they've forgotten all real quick how much we depended on the Russians during the war, but I don't want to get any history lesson here. But I mean, you know, you don't have that type of listening population anymore. Our population over the past 30 years has become so de-educated and so desirous of achieving some type of wealth or whatever they think they are. They think they're going to profit by these people. But the main thing is they are too damn stupid and uneducated to realize what is being done to them.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
You know, I talked to this lady I know who was against NPR being funded.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. And I didn't say anything to her because, I mean, I realized I'd be wasting my breath. And, you know, I don't suffer food sadly, as you well know. And she said, well, why should my tax dollars pay for this stuff that comes over NPR? And I said, do you ever watch NPR? No. And I said, what do you have against it? Her reply was, I don't know.
Oh, you mean she didn't say, oh, it's liberal.
She said, I don't know. I said, do you ever watch it? No.
I used to deal with a certain radio station general manager who would become positively veins popping in the forehead apoplectic at the mere mention of NPR.
Well, know who you're talking about.
Oh, yes, you do.
I do indeed. And, you know, people like that can be, and I talked to that same individual. No names are going to be mentioned here. And just as slick and just as smooth and just as calm and, you know, beguiling to me if he could possibly be, because he knew who he knew who he was talking to because of my past experiences with him. But I was thinking to myself, you know, what a snake.
Yeah.
What an absolute snake.
And would maintain that calm demeanor until public radio was brought up, and then why should my tax dollars have to support that liberalism?
I don't understand, because these people, like I say, they don't, you know, when I watch NPR, I love Nova and the different British comedies and things of that nature that are on it that are just incredibly born of high quality.
Yeah. Can you imagine, just for a moment, you or anybody else in the Horn family, Jim, can you imagine what would happen if, say, the History Channel or the Discovery Network got hold of Nova? I shudder to even contemplate it.
Well, you know, the History Channel and the Discovery Channel have their good points and their bad points, and, you know, what can I say? Because I'm a history buff, history was my education and basically part of my training, but nonetheless, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Quite all right.
It would appear to me as though I don't want to see the truth manipulated, because the manipulation of the truth, with that, they breach not only the moat, but they've also blown a hole in the wall of any type of cogent and reasonable thinking. They really have.
Yes, because, frankly...
And this has been done before.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about. I sent you an email on it.
Yeah.
And I think that basically what we're having here is, I hate to say it, is being a devotee of the cyclical version of history, it's the big lie. And the perversion of the truth, not the whole truth, but just enough of the truth to give it the appearance of veracity.
Yeah. And of course, Jim, I mean, we can name names here. The fact of the matter is, the United States gladly used German technology in advancing the U.S. space program, Wernher von Braun and his team and everything. Why is it so hard to believe that there would be elements within the United States that would gladly put to work Goebbels' efforts as well? Because, frankly, evil bastard that he was, he was also a pioneer in that kind of communications.
Absolutely, because Adolf Hitler was the first politician who had those means at his disposal. The radio at that time, and also the airplane. I mean, the big thing with Hitler and Goebbels back in the 1932 elections was Hitler over Germany. And Hitler was crisscrossing, making all sorts of hate-filled speeches and making promises that were dealt or are based upon, based upon destruction of a nation. And he was able to subvert that country by legal means. I mean, he had tried to do it back in the 1920s with his putsch into Munich, and that landed him up in Landsberg prison. So he decided on a new tack, and that would be to do it politically and to do it within the arms of the state. That's exactly what he did. And
I mean, there's a very famous TV show about the rise of the advertising industry in the late 50s or into the early 60s, Mad Men. And even advertising changes in the post-World War II world. And I would say directly as a result of the way that propaganda, that we had learned to manipulate information as a result of that war.
Yeah, we did.
And it continues to this day.
Not only did we learn from their rocket science program, but we also learned from some of their other techniques and methods too, because they were in fact, for their period in time, very successful in subverting a very honorable country into a beast. And the catchword was back in those days, howl with the wolves.
That'll set the little hairs up on the back of your neck too.
I mean, that's exactly what they said. Those were exactly the same things they said. And, you know, people knew, well, they didn't know. Like today, they didn't pay attention.
I mean,
with Hitler, I mean, he said exactly what he was going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I have listened to his speeches.
And along those lines, Jim, the Republican Party has told us what they want to do. They don't make any bones about it. Ask Ron Paul. He'll tell you. He wants Social Security over. He wants Medicare gone. He wants Medicaid non-existent. Unemployment is just another welfare program for people who don't want to go to work.
Well, for being a physician, how lacking in compassion can he be?
Well, God Almighty, I mean, I've seen a lot of the quotes from his filthy little newsletter, Jim, but I was dumbstruck, and you know it takes a lot to do that to me. I was dumbstruck when I read that quote from his newsletter about people enjoying being sick because of the pity that they get. I mean, I wanted to put my fist through something when I read that.
Oh, Bob.
It was too damn much. I mean, that...
Only that man could be at the bedside of an individual who has literally been turned into the Elephant Man, who a year or two before was a healthy human being. The AIDS thing. And, you know, that's something else that bothers me.
I mean, there are just some things in this world, Jim, and I didn't mean to cut you off. There are just some things in this world that you say that there are bells that cannot be unrung, and once rung, toll out a message that person is no longer fit to participate in civil society.
No, you cannot withdraw an arrow once it's been discharged or a round once it's been fired. And he basically said that's exactly how he felt, and that's, you know, I believe these people when they say this stuff. I mean, a lot of people believe what Hitler said, but he was telling the truth about his intentions. Number one, about German hegemony. Number two, the destructive fury throughout Europe. Number three, about, you know, Germany today, tomorrow, the world. I mean, he believed that stuff, and he spoke it out. I mean, in speech after speech after speech.
We had a clip last week of Ron Paul. Sandra sent it along. A clip last week of Ron Paul talking about how Abraham Lincoln
got us into the Civil War in order to destroy the intent of the founders. And there are quotes in these articles that I've referred to today in which he argues, just plain and simple, absolutely not, that it was a terrible mistake for the United States to enter World War II. I mean, of all the stuff that's out there that people can generally agree on, isn't the United States entry into World War II one of them? But not Ron Paul. Oh, hell no.
He said our entering into World War II was a mistake?
Yes, sir.
Well, I think he and Joe Kennedy would be real happy together. I didn't know that. And I am gobsmacked to hear that. I mean, our entry into World War II was basically...
And this guy may convince a majority of Republican voters in Iowa that he should be the president of the United States. I mean, that's the stuff that makes me upend the tequila bottle, Jim.
I just wonder what he said about the Russians' entry into World War II. I would love to hear his assertion of... I'm making up words like that crazy Bo Deedle.
No, but that's a dandy.
His assertion of the influence of the Russians in World War II would have been. Would he have said they shouldn't have gotten into it too?
No, he really didn't give a damn what the Europeans did to each other. But what he did say very clearly, that he said that getting into the Second World War to save the Jews was no reason for the United States to be in the war.
Well, Bob, unfortunately, we didn't get into the war because of that, because we knew what was happening in Europe, and we knew exactly what happened. And, of course, it was the Pearl Harbor incident in 1941 that caused us to get into it, because there were a lot of people in this country who did not want to go to war. And
Lindbergh.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a tremendous peace movement, but then it took the Japanese attack upon the Pearl Harbor base to get us into it actively. But even before that, Roosevelt was supporting actively Churchill and, you know, England when she stood alone. And we realized exactly the nemesis of Hitler and exactly what his heartland theory was, how he wanted to capture this and take that and this, that, and the other. And, there it is. 1941 was not a good year for Adolf Hitler. Number one, he invaded the Soviet Union. And number two, he declared war upon the United States. And, of course, I wonder what Ron Paul would think about the influence from World War II in getting us out of the Depression.
Oh, no, well, see, no, because the free market has to do that.
Oh, bullshit.
No, really, Jim, I'm not kidding. I mean, maybe this is our conversation about fundamentalists all over again. But that's where libertarians live.
I don't know where they live, Bob. I just can't even begin to...
They live in this rarefied atmosphere where they breathe nothing but the effluvium of the rotting corpse of Ayn Rand. And the free market must fix all. I mean, the list for Ron Paul, for instance, the list of what is unconstitutional in this country is longer than the list of what is.
Well, don't they realize that a totally free market economy that they envision is like an engine without a governor? You know what I'm saying?
I think they do recognize it, and see, but their argument would be that, you know, that engine, if it overheats and blows itself up, that the market will correct itself, and the free market will... I mean, it is, if you get really, really into a philosophical conversation with a libertarian, what you will find out is that the free market is their god. It's their religion, Jim.
I realize that, and I've tried to tell several, and I've simply stopped even trying, because you can't convince these people exactly what you're trying to...
Well, and I learned a new word today, as a matter of fact. We had a running little joke going on Twitter last night about what Star Trek races various Republican presidential candidates would be, and I was arguing that Ron Paul was a Ferengi. But no, lo and behold, I get up this morning and I learn a new word. The people who follow Ron Paul are Romulans.
Oh, those people who had all those gears attached to their faces and bodies?
No, that's the Borg.
Okay.
No, the Romulans were introduced in the first Star Trek series, and the premise being that no human had ever seen a Romulan, or a Romulan. And the main reason for that is that they're sneak thieves and cut purses, and the only part of a Romulan you ever see is asshole and elbow as they're running away. After they've, you know, shivved you in the back.
I see. I understand. I'm sorry. I'm not too up on my...
No, I was just trying to clarify that a little bit. But they have an almost inhuman attachment to this fantasy world of a free market that really doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't. Not really. No, it simply doesn't. It's an economic chimera.
Exactly. Well, Jim, this has been a lovely conversation. I've got a roll on, however, because A, my propane has run out back here, and so has the time of the show.
All right. Thank you. Good night.
Take care, Jim. Be well.
You too.
Bye now. It's our buddy Jim. Getting cold back here. The nice weather we had on Christmas is fast going away. Just a couple of quick emails to share with you. One coming in from Darlene. Regarding my reference in conversation with Reverbo to Tom Brokaw. Brokaw is one of those elitist journalists, part of the 1%. He used to come into my father's shop with massive wads of cash that he was always sure to pull out of his pocket and display for effect. Not out of his wallet, mind you, but out of his pocket, because the wads of cash were too thick to fit into a standard wallet. One evening, he was a guest on Charlie Rose, another well-paid establishment media personality, and was asked about Occupy Wall Street. His response was not very insightful. A journalist like him is not capable of understanding the true meaning, import, and motivation behind the Occupy movement. He just doesn't get it. I don't think it's intentional. He is just too far removed from the everyday realities of regular, hardworking, suffering people in this country to have a clue as to why they are out on the streets protesting. And he can't pronounce R's or S's either, by the way. And Robert in Australia... he says, public broadcasting in Australia is done by the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Part of its charter is to deliver radio and television services to places the commercial broadcasters will not go, and that's what it does, as well as to all major population centers. Check out a map of Australia and understand we have a population of about 25 million people spread across the continent. The ABC delivers its services, 3 TV channels, and national and local radio channels to just about everyone. It used to cost the average Australian 8 cents a day. That's probably about 12 cents a day by now, and it's worth every cent. Because it goes to the commons, to the public good. Great conversations this evening, everyone. Looking forward to tomorrow night. I hope you'll join me. I plan on being here, and we will extend this now 8-year-long conversation as it rolls toward the end of 2011. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky in the chat room, to our news ninjas Gene and Susan, to our blogger Texas Betsy, Reverbo, who you heard this evening, my head writer David in Tennessee, who had the night off, to John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer. Thank you. And to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you. And, of course... to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.